Friday edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. We're going to do a preview of that epic Warriors-Spurs tilt on Saturday. But first, let's get to some news. Danny, really just kind of buried a little bit, but one of the bigger pieces of news that we've had this year, just in the sense that it will affect free agency for basically every team.
Yeah, it's a gigantic piece of news, and that is that there was an agreement that the moratorium is, instead of being, I believe it was going to be 11 days, it is now going to be 5. And it has far-reaching effects. When I was writing the piece for the Sporting News about the $1 billion, a big part of kind of why the season was going to be weird is because of this super long moratorium. And this change, not only shortening it, but shortening it all the way to 5 days, completely changes that.
Yeah, it does. And the biggest way that I think it is going to change things is with respect to restricted free agents. When it was 11 days, which is longer than it has been, restricted free agents can't really agree to terms with another team until after the moratorium, until that clock gets started. And I think we saw, especially last year, a lot of restricted free agents, Chris Middleton, Jay Crowder among them, even both of those guys who probably actually could have gotten more money had they really gone into the market. Draymond Green was another one. All guys who were Jay Crowder wasn't a max guy, but Middleton and Green certainly were, took less than the max. I think in large part because their teams just came to them with offers right away, and their agents were concerned, probably rightly so, that if you wait until the end of the moratorium to get an offer sheet from another team, all those offers are kind of going to be dried up. And so you might as well agree right away. Now, when you only have to wait really 5 days before you can sign that offer sheet, that will mean that those guys are probably, and of course, with all there being so much more money around the league, I think restricted free agents are now in a much better position. And also, when you consider that it may take Kevin Durant some time to make his decision, maybe he won't even make his decision until right towards the end of the moratorium, we could see really, like in 2014, a lot of delay for everybody signing because there will be that domino effect from Durant.
Yeah, to give an idea of what this means in terms of timing, a lot of people, including myself, we kind of made fun of the Sacramento Leverages because of how many guys they swung and missed on. They signed Rajon Rondo on July 3rd and Kufos on the 4th. And there was such a long time between that and when the whole DeAndre mess happened. And now that time is 1 day. So that's a really big difference. As you said, for the restricted free agents, it's a very different opportunity cost. And it might be just functionally impossible for enough teams to agree to contracts in that time that there will just be teams that have space. And so at that point, it's a lot more reasonable to take a 3-day bet on a Harrison Barnes than it is in a different market if you really stretched it out more.
Right. And you also won't have those teams with that money burning a hole in their pocket for as long. If you get to July 3rd and maybe you missed on your first couple of guys, then by that point, maybe you say, hey, rather than going with plan E, we'll just wait another 2 or 3 days, get in on these restricted free agents. And then, since there's not that much difference between plan E and plan F, just wait and see whether plan F is still there if the restricted free agents don't work out. So this is probably bad news for teams like the Warriors in particular, who are Harrison Barnes will be, and especially if the Warriors are trying to get their own stuff done. Imagine if they have Kevin Durant potentially making a decision, and then you have Harrison Barnes signing an offer sheet while KD is still trying to make that decision, and you know that once you match on Barnes, you're not going to be able to trade him right away. And so that would mean the Warriors could potentially be in a situation. It probably won't happen, but you just see sort of this is a way to lay out what the conundrum could be for some teams. You could be in a situation where, hey, we got to decide either we're going to lose KD or we're going to have to sign him and lose any chance at Durant or maybe whatever other free agent. And so I think this is good overall. Don't get me wrong. I think that restricted free agency, having to kind of wait longer than regular free agency, makes it even worse for restricted free agents who are already in kind of an unfairly limited bargaining position. But that shows you what difference this could make with that example.
Yeah, and the only other thing I'll add is that the part of the reason that I really like the moratorium is that it provides this kind of flexibility to make moves happen. You can think about it just with the way that you can combine transactions, like what Boston did, where they did some of their deals, because you can, you have the time to like basically to make all of this stuff work before everything gets baked into the cake. And so you can get some flexibility. That said, there was going to be less of that this year anyway, just because teams are going to be operating from space. It's not going to be over the cap, under the cap dancing.
I agree with you. So let's talk a little Warriors Spurs, then we can get to the rest of this news. And also, we're going to talk some about the Knicks, who we saw in person in a desultory loss on Wednesday. And really, they seem to be a mess in a number of ways. I'm sure Knicks fans will love to stick around for that analysis. But but maybe non-Knicks fans who enjoy the schadenfreude will be interested in it. But let's talk Warriors Spurs first. I mean, the number one thing that sticks out to me here is that Andre Iguodala isn't going to be playing.
Iguodala, I think you could argue he makes a little bit less of a difference against the Spurs just because they don't really have a guy to stick on him, but he's such a great team defender, and he's one of the...
Wait, what do you mean? They got Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah, but do you think of Kawhi the same way as, like, Durant, just with how much the Warriors... But granted, the Warriors always struggle with him. I see him as a little bit different of a player, but...
I actually do think of it as different with Kawhi and Andre, because I think Andre probably has more value added against Kawhi. Number one, the Spurs don't do a ton of stuff with, like, you know, the 3-1 pick and rolls, trying to get the switch, which the Cavs and the Thunder will do a lot. So that's one reason. I think that you are in a position where you can have your primary defender on Kawhi more often. And then also, I think just that the way Kawhi likes to play, Andre provides maybe even more value added on him. And maybe LeBron you could throw into this category too. Like, none of them have ever stopped KD. But, you know, with him trying to post up, the length that Andre provides, his ability to just kind of disrupt guys with his hands, make him a little bit uncomfortable, I think that's incredibly important against Kawhi. Klay Thompson is going to have no chance against Kawhi at all. He's just going to get completely abused down low. And I think Harrison Barnes is another guy who, you know, maybe on a straight post up might be able to hold up okay against Kawhi, but he doesn't quite have the bend and the lateral quickness, I think, to keep up with him on some of those ISOs. So I think actually Andre matters as much. And also the other thing about Andre too is that for a team that moves the ball, that will try to get backdoors, his intelligence off the ball is also incredibly important. So I think he actually might be more important against the Spurs even than, say, the Thunder, and probably as important as against the Cavs.
Yeah, I could see that. I'd have it below the Cavs just because I think with the way their offense works. But yeah, and also his minutes, they don't really have an effective replacement for it, which is always, of course, important when you're facing the Spurs, who are, in my opinion, the deepest team in the league.
Yeah, I mean, if it's going to be Sean Livingston trying to guard Kawhi, like, Sean can be real good against guys who are not strength matchups, but you know, he'll just bounce off of dudes when it's a stronger guy. So that's something to consider as well. And Kawhi is just incredibly strong. That's one of the things that came out of that Lee Jenkins piece on him. And obviously just from watching him too, you can tell that. So that's the number one thing to me. Because I think really the biggest advantage that the Warriors have against the Spurs isn't their offense. It's that I think the Spurs really can struggle to score against the Warriors. They certainly did in Oakland when they only put up 90 points. So without Andre, I think the Warriors' defense is kind of compromised, and that's one of the big reasons that I am predicting the Spurs are going to take this one.
Yeah, it definitely is. And does it seem like the Spurs are going to have everybody? From what I've heard, it seems like they actually will.
Yeah, and also you'd have to imagine the Spurs will be a little more motivated than in their typical regular season tilt because of A, how they got waxed in Oakland, B, the chance that they still have can still go undefeated at home. I think maybe the Warriors are going to be very motivated too, obviously. I mean, I think that they, whenever they play against a good team, especially on the road, they are up for it. And we've seen that most of their losses have been against on the road against teams that aren't that good. So I think the Warriors will also want to beat the Spurs at home to have them be the only ones who go undefeated at home. That might be another aspect of this as well. But then, of course, the Warriors are going to be on the road coming off a back-to-back against Dallas tonight. You know, and they'll probably struggle a little bit more because they don't have Andre in that game, too. They could be pretty tired. So, and the Spurs have been unbelievable at home. So I think you obviously would have to pick the Spurs in this game if you're being rational about it.
Certainly. One thing I think that I'm going to be watching in this is that LaMarcus majorly struggled in the first game, primarily when Draymond Green was on him. We just saw Draymond actually have a really nice game on Porzingis, obviously a very different player. And if that continues, obviously it's still a small set of data points. It's really only two, and because those teams, even with when he was on the Blazers, never played a playoff series. But it's worth watching all the same.
Yeah, it is. I mean, LaMarcus even said in the locker room after the game that he felt like he had the mismatch on Draymond, even though he had scored, you know, had one of the worst games of his career. And Draymond, I think, has always defended him quite well with his low center of gravity. I mean, Draymond, what people don't realize about him is he has, with his short neck, he is about the same standing reach as like a lot of centers do, despite the fact that he's shorter than they are. So, and that's also, I think, kind of how he blocks a lot of these shots that he does. I mean, maybe once or twice a game, you'll see it. An unsuspecting player will take a jump shot and Draymond's contest will just completely flummox them because, I mean, I think just when you play basketball a lot, you don't see guys with their arms up, but you just have a sense for kind of how tall they are and that correlates with how high they can get when contesting you and how long their arms are. And so Draymond has such a disconnect between his height and how high he actually gets his hand on those contests. And then he has such quick hands too. He can get his hand in there more quickly than shooters expect. He'll either block jump shots or force guys into ugly misses when he surprises them with his length on the perimeter.
Yeah, so something I was considering with this game is, do you think it's a lot more important, like the impact of this game is a lot larger if the Warriors win than if the Spurs win?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're talking about the Warriors are missing, you know, maybe their fourth best guy, and the Spurs are at home. The Warriors are on a back-to-back. They're not expected to win this. I mean, you could say that the impact is higher because the Warriors are trying to set the all-time win record. But in terms of these two teams matching up in the playoffs, the Spurs' confidence, I mean, they're obviously, they've been in a million games. But if they get beat in this game, and especially if it's not, you know, real close, you could see them starting to think, all right, you know, we might have a major problem with this team.
Yeah, and also the Warriors winning this game, as you mentioned, would not only in terms of history, but would basically lock in them getting the number one seed, which is important for a lot of other reasons, because I think that would give them a five-game lead with the Spurs having some challenging games and the Warriors having enough time to kind of put enough distance. Because something I wrote about for Warriors World on Thursday is that I think Kerr should have it as a goal to basically have the number one seed locked up by the next time they play the Spurs, because then Pop might take his foot off the gas pedal a little bit more. Then you don't have to stress as much, but we'll see.
Yeah. Another thing to watch, obviously, is how Tony Parker does defensively. But I think the number one thing to me is, are the Spurs going to be able to score on the Warriors? And the Warriors played with unbelievable defensive intensity that last game. I mean, they basically played one of the most perfect games of basketball I've ever seen. Also, Steph was making some ridiculous shots, even for him, in that game. So I think, you know, whether they can, Danny Green and Kawhi can do a little better a job on Steph this time as well. We're not really going to see it all, probably the Green at center lineup, unless maybe if the Warriors get way down, they might go to that. But obviously without Andre, it makes that lineup much less viable. And then, yeah, seeing whether Tony Parker can do anything offensively, LaMarcus do anything offensively, and finally just whether the Spurs in general are going to be able to get their passing going. Their three-point attempts as well is going to be big for me, and they've shooting a lot less threes this year. Are the Warriors going to be able to force them into just pretty much ISOing every time? That's another thing to look at as well.
Yeah, and I'm intrigued. You mentioned this, and something I'd been thinking about is the Spades has done a surprisingly nice job the last couple of weeks, you know, especially since Azeli was out and now, you know, just with Draymond playing less center. And the Spurs are not particularly well suited to handle a center who likes shooting where he shoots.
Yeah, now that he's shooting threes, he's actually been really, really effective lately. And he's just shooting the set shot rainbow, you know, very effectively. And you wonder why he wasn't doing that for the past 2.5 years, whether that was coaching or whether he's just worked on it to the point that he can take that shot now. You know, I expect it was more the former. So he's going to be critical because San Antonio's bench performance has been one of the greatest of all time. Manu is back now. He's playing awesomely. David West, who is one of the few Spurs who actually had a good game in that first game, he will be back as well. And then, you know, kind of the way Kerr has been doing it is playing Spates and then also getting Anderson Varejao some minutes at backup center. Varejao continues to be awful. Hopefully when Azili comes back, that experiment will end entirely. But the hope would be that Kerr will just go with more Spates and Bogut in this game, because I think if we see Varejao getting much run, especially against someone like David West or Dia, it's going to be big trouble for the Warriors.
Another question is whether Pop will choose to deploy Haka in this game. We just don't know whether he'll, because sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't.
Yeah, with Bogut actually playing better, he actually has been much better over the last, like, probably 15 games. So would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say so.
And I think just knowing for him that he's actually being relied upon now, that it's not just, oh, we could go with Green at center, easily could just play instead. They still have Spates. Like, really being the starting center, knowing that he's going to play a major role, I think has been huge for him, because he could just sort of check out mentally, or if his elbow's not feeling right that game, he just sort of, like, you know, will get in foul trouble and not really play a major role and know that it's okay. Now he can't do that. So maybe they would go with that. I think normally you wouldn't go hack a Bogut, because taking him out, the Warriors could almost be better. You might, if they were to go with Green at center, especially. But in this game, you know, that's not the case. I think they really need Bogut.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I don't really have much to add.
That Warriors-Spurs game is going to be awesome. And if you want to get tickets to it, you're in San Antonio, or tickets to any other NBA game with the playoffs coming up, or tickets to a concert or baseball with that starting, use SeatGeek, our longtime sponsor, first sponsor of the podcast. They aggregate all of the ticket buying sites together so that you don't have to worry that you're not getting the best deal. My uncle actually just got tickets to a Wizards-Bulls game in Washington, got a great deal, and then got to watch his hometown Bulls get smacked. But that wasn't SeatGeek's fault, because he got a great deal. And right now, my listeners can use the CapSpace code, familiar one, all one word, to get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Go into the settings tab. Once you've downloaded the app, click on add a promo code, put in CapSpace, and SeatGeek will send you that $20 rebate as soon as you buy your tickets. And of course, SeatGeek can also be used to sell your tickets as well. They have a metric called deal score that can either tell you if you're buying tickets, whether it's a good or bad deal, or give you a suggestion on how much to sell your tickets for. So it's painless to sell, painless to buy. Everyone saves money, including you, when you use that CapSpace code. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the Knicks now. We saw them on Wednesday. I thought it was maybe the second most hopeless loss that any team has had at Oracle this year. And when I say hopeless, just giving you the impression that they had no chance of ever winning the game. I mean, number one would probably be that first Phoenix game. But would you agree with that it was just such a desultory performance from the Knicks?
It was bad, and it was discouraging in ways that Phoenix game wasn't. Yeah, they played badly. The Warriors, I don't think they played super duper well early on, but the Knicks just had none chance. Like, you weren't there, but the comparison for me was the Phoenix game, not the first one, but the second one, the one that was about a week ago, where the Warriors didn't play great, and the Suns were still in it, and then they went on that weird run and pushed it up and kept going, and the Knicks was like, I didn't see a path for them. And one of the crazy things with that game was that I think Melo had like 24 or 26. He played fine. All the other starters had 2 points each and shot like 4 of 24 from the field, so they were just getting very little from those guys, and that's a troubling sign when you consider that some of those players are going to be on the team long term.
Yeah, well,
maybe.
They started, I mean, Rambis, I'd never really gotten a chance to see his work close up before. When he was in Minnesota, he obviously had one of the worst performances ever. People forget that he actually coached the Lakers right before Phil got there. And they got swept, of course, by that Spurs juggernaut in 1999. But what struck me is just with both their personnel and the triangle, in the first quarter, they had one shot in the restricted area and one three, and were really lucky to score, I think, 19 points. And even when they were running the triangle, a lot of its actions are to get long twos. They weren't even getting open long twos. It was just such a struggle. They couldn't even get the ball to Melo in a space where he could do anything with it. Porzingis, you know, was not getting in a position where he could do anything. It was just he would catch the ball in the wing position on the strong side in the triangle, and Draymond Green would get so far into him that he just would almost have to turn his back to the play. And when you catch the ball at that position in the triangle, you really can't do anything, right? If someone pressures up on you, there's nowhere to go. You could try to drive. Fine. There's a guy in the corner and there's a guy in the post standing right in front of you. So even if you try to drive, you can't go anywhere from that position. Like, all you can do is try to enter it into the post. And now teams make that really difficult there. You can even pretty much deny the corner if you want to with impunity. And so the only path that's available is just to reverse the ball and try and do some stuff on the backside. It's really, it's the offense does not work anymore unless you have elite talent. And then even then, I think you're kind of stifling things. But yeah, I mean, the fact that just Porzingis, he got maybe like one good shot all night was really troubling to me.
He has such a competitive advantage as a pick and pop center. Like, you think about what he can do versus what other guys can handle. And his dribbling, even against centers, I think he can do a better job facing up than I thought he could at this age, and he'll get better at that with time. So you have that massive competitive advantage with him now and for the next, let's say, 5-10 years. They didn't use it at all. At all. And like,
they literally did not run a single pick and pop with him in a game where they could not score to save their lives.
Yeah, like, we talked about it when the Warriors played Miami and a couple other teams, that I noticed it when they played Phoenix as well, that a lot of opposing centers, when you kind of give them the space, they just hang out in the lane. It's what we talked about with Most Bates. Porzingis is that, but he's way better at it. So you get a guy like Andrew Bogut, and you have to make a choice there if you play him at center. If you play him at the four, Draymond Green is way better at that, and most fours are better at defending it. So you're losing a lot of what you could potentially gain.
Rambis has had some disturbing quotes, and Chris Herring had an article about this today in the Wall Street Journal, that the way Porzingis is being used is concerning, I guess we'll say. Chris writes for an esteemed publication, so he can't use words like crazy and questionable the way we can. I think maybe use questionable, but yeah. So Rambis has been saying, oh, we really want Porzingis to be the first guy down, get some post ups. And he's athletic enough, we could even see him playing the three someday.
And I vomited.
it's so bad. And really, there's, when you're struggling as badly as they were to score, I mean, pick and pop is probably the easiest thing that you can do in the NBA to get yourself a good shot on a consistent basis. Now, for a lot of guys, it'll end up being a long two, but you, at least the guy will be open. So, and if they switch that, now, all right, now it makes sense for Porzingis to go down in the post if he's guarded by, like, Steph Curry, a point guard or something like that. I mean, those were some of the other foibles that Rambis had. I mean, one was basically matching Jose Calderon's minutes with Steph Curry instead of Langston Galloway. That didn't go too well for the Knicks.
Not playing Jerry and Grant with Porzingis basically at all was a little bit of a problem. That's just a broader problem than that.
Yeah, at least until garbage time.
Well, and the way that they handled double teams, like, so the Warriors would just, once they realized that they could do it when they needed to, and the Knicks basically never countered anything the Warriors did to stifle them. They never really changed anything. They never adapted.
And they got completely out-hustled as well. You know, the Warriors had probably like four or five leakouts off of defensive rebounds, like touchdown passes for layups or dunks. It was just, and you just watching the Knicks, you felt like the only way that they didn't really get any system buckets going back door or anything either. Every shot was contested. Almost all of them were long twos. They ended up scoring like, 85 points in what was a really fast game. And of course, not being able to stop the Warriors either. I've rarely seen, and it was funny too, because the Warriors didn't score until there was 8:11 left in the first quarter. They still scored 31 points in the first quarter. And you still felt, even when the Warriors hadn't scored in the first 4 minutes, just looking at the process of how the Knicks were trying to score and the shots that they were giving up to the Warriors, you're like, there's no way you're going to win this game. Like, a team that hasn't given up any points, and you just knew, like, there was no chance they had of competing whatsoever.
Something else that struck me along the hustle note was that the Knicks, and I talked about this when I wrote about the Nets, and we've talked about it with them, is that when you're in a big market and you have a team that isn't very good, one of the big possibilities you have is to just try guys out. You'll get people that are interested, and if somebody works out, you can lock them in on a, you know, you try to find the next Tyler Johnson, basically. And the Knicks are paying Lou Amundsen, who is a fine player and probably a good locker room presence, but they could be cycling through guys. They could be trying to find somebody who, at the very least, hustles, but at the most, you know, maybe shows a little something. I mean, I think about a guy like Christian Wood just because he's my guy. But whoever, find those, and if they don't work, you move along to the next guy, and if they do work, then you got something for next year or for moving forward that you didn't have before. And you owe it to yourself, if you have limited means to get better, as the Knicks do because they don't have their own first-round pick and they have Melo's cap obligation unless he waives his no trade. You have to do those things. It's non-negotiable if you have the ability to create the space. And they do. And it's so infuriating to me. It's a longer-term thing that these major market teams are just basically refusing to be creative with their roster and maximizing the fact that players want to play there.
And that's all the more galling because they actually had a ton of success finding those guys last year. Langston Galloway, Lance Thomas, those are guys who actually, and I think the Knicks actually did miss Lance Thomas in that Warriors game as the one guy who can play any defense on the wing. But those are guys that they were able to find with those extra roster spots, kind of cycling guys through. And so not doing that this year, you're right, is really kind of a waste. Let's get to a couple of news items about them, though. The first is that they've signed Tony Roten. There was an initial report that was erroneous, saying that they had signed him for 3 years. They were not able to do that because they are over the cap, and all they have is the minimum exception, and that only goes for 2 years. You would need either cap room or the mid-level or mini-mid-level to sign someone for three or more years. But Roten apparently has been signed now, but according to Rambis's pregame press conference on Wednesday, he will not really be joining the team until summer league. I guess he'll be doing some more rehab. He's still coming back from a torn ACL that he suffered last year.
Roten is he's an interesting talent. I always worry about him running an offense, but if you can find a role
and a terrible fit for the triangle, of course.
Of course, but yeah, who knows? That sometimes you just have to deal with that. but yes.
I mean, Phil likes big guards, but
he does.
Him not being able to shoot and being a guy who's a pick and roll guy, has the ball in his hand, I can't see him really succeeding in that offense.
Yeah. The other Knicks piece of news is that Ian Begley, I think, was the one who reported that the Knicks think Melo could reconsider waiving his no trade clause, which is something that basically everybody's been waiting on either way. And that ties in with something Dan Feldman, I give him credit for talking about it before, that his trade bonus actually starts mattering this summer.
Yeah. And for those who forget, when you have a trade bonus, it basically pays you a bonus on a percentage of your remaining salary when you get traded. However, if you are already making the max, that doesn't apply. And for these last couple of years, Melo has basically been making the max. But with the cap going up so much, he will now have some headroom between what he's making and the max. And that trade bonus can now be paid out. I think it's about $9 million or so that he could make if he is traded in the next league year. If I were him, I would certainly be looking into that if I wanted to win. He's expressed frustration. He was a little bit more circumspect in his comments after the game on Wednesday. But then the question will become, what can they really get for him? And while he might be willing to waive his no-trade clause, he still isn't going to want to go somewhere unless it's to a winner. And then the question is, do those winners really even have that much assets to give the Knicks? So it's still, even if you were willing to consider it, finding an acceptable deal for the Knicks is far easier said than done.
For sure.
Let's go through another signing, sir.
Do you want to do signings first?
Yes.
Okay, so Alan Williams, a Phoenix native, another guy who had the benefit, signed for a 10-day contract, and Phoenix signed him for the remainder of the season per Paul Coro, and they have what he classified as a team option for next year. I think that might be non-guaranteed just because of the leverage the team has.
Yeah, and Williams is a guy who was an analytics darling, one of these shorter power forwards, but strong, great rebounder, played in China, as I recall, this year. And had a great summer league for the Rockets as well, put up a few 2010 games in Vegas. So now I think that's a good investment for the Suns. They can always use guys who are going to play hard. I don't know if it'll help their defense that much, but for the minimum, anyone who can play at all certainly helps. They don't really have a ton of guys at power forward right now, so you might as well audition him. And he could be the sort of guy who could come in off the bench, get you some offensive rebounds, maybe a little bit of post scoring, if everything works out with him. And I mean, I think we talk about taking a flyer on guys, and usually in scouting terms, that'll be, all right, this guy's really athletic. Let's see if we can make him into something. But there are also guys who look really good by the stats that may not look that athletic, but you still have some reason to believe they could be good. So why not get him on your roster and see what you can do with them? And maybe his production will outstrip what you're seeing with the stats. So I think he, just because of those statistical translations, I feel like has perhaps more upside than your typical like 15th man.
And the opportunity cost was also low because, as far as I can think offhand, the Suns have some roster spots available for, you know, for the summer, of course, and for next season. So if it works out, they're not in a crunch. They're not like, let's say, Boston or somebody like that, where they're going to have to really make these tough decisions. So why not? It works out nicely for them.
More Kings drama, huh?
Yes. So there are two different articles that came out, or two different reports that came out about the Kings. Ken Berger reported that that George Karl is likely going to be fired this summer, and that I believe it came after, came on the heels of Sam Amick's report. He wrote, was mainly writing about DeMarcus Cousins, and was saying, you know, about the drama that's there and everything. And he
just got suspended basically for blowing up at Karl, and then after his suspension, Boogie said, "Well, it was the coach who suspended me, not the organization."
Yeah, so there's all that conflict, and so what Amick said is that DeMarcus likely will not be available to be traded until at the trade deadline or around then next year. And that makes complete sense because the Kings are moving into a new arena at the beginning of next season. And so you don't want to trade your best player for something like that, especially. And what was most concerning to me about his report is the idea that the Kings might not be interested in draft assets, because while it is possible to get it in terms of established players, Sacramento benefits a lot from team control of a draft pick.
The problem with that is trading superstars for established players. I mean, trading superstars rarely works out to begin with, but trading them for established players really doesn't work out. Because, number one, established players who are just kind of good but not superstars are a worse value. Those are the worst value guys in the league. Either, and even if they're kind of, you know, third, fourth tier guys, they have to be appropriately paid very soon, or they will have mid tier salaries where they're probably overpaid. Rookies, max guys, even second year guys or guys off the street, like those have the potential to be the best value guys, guys who have just been signed in free agency, much harder to get bargains there. So that's, and especially when you consider that Cousins will probably be underpaid by, you know, $10 million a season or so once this cap race comes in. I mean, you look at some of the trades in NBA history where stars were traded for established players. Yeah, that doesn't work out too well, right? I mean, like the Charles Barkley trade is the one that shows up to me, where they traded for Jeff Hornacek. All right, a nice player. Tim Perry, and I think like Andrew Lang or something was the last guy who Barkley got traded for. And of course, the Sixers were immediately just terrible once they acquired those guys. You're just so much better off for your team getting draft assets that at least will be cheap and have more upside than the already established players. So even if such a trade were available, that is probably the worst thing for the franchise in the long term if that's what they're planning on.
The other piece in Sam's report is that assistant coach Nancy Lieberman has been, I think the word was, identified as a Ron Adive confidant and has been unofficially exiled, which is just unbelievably great phrasing. And a terrible, terrible story, but great, great phrasing. Beautifully done by Sam.
Oh, man. That is just the amount of drama there is pretty remarkable. And too bad that actually casts, you know, a little bit of a negative light on what had been a nice story of her being the second woman to be an assistant coach in the NBA. Can we go back to Boogie for a second? I thought of one more thing. Let's say they didn't have this going into a new arena thing. Would you try to just trade him this, and you don't have any pressures from ownership, you're just in a vacuum, would you try to trade him this summer, or would you wait until the trade deadline next year?
I would have listened to offers at this trade deadline, and I would have more heavily considered moving him over the summer, because in the summer you have a lot more flexibility. I would actually, the time that I would be most interested in is draft time. right before then, because then you can make the picks yourself. And the Kings are already looking in the range of the picks they're going to be getting, so it's not like they're going to be worried about, oh, we haven't scouted guys in the top 5 to 10 picks. They should be doing, granted, teams should be doing that anyway, but especially in this case. So, yeah, I would consider that other than the whole circumstance, for sure.
Yeah, they definitely, the sooner you trade them, the more you get for them, obviously, right? That's why you do it at next year's trade deadline. Doing it any later than next year's trade deadline, I think, would be foolish. I might wait until then. I think you certainly listen now. I might wait until then just to see, all right, maybe we can get a new coach in. Maybe we'll do it right here. Vlade can pick his coach. We're going to, at the very least, I mean, because that's been one of the biggest problems, is not even that, you know, they've been incompetent, but that there's been this factionalization where you've had the Vivek faction, you've had the Pete D'Alessandro faction, you've had the Vlade faction, you've had the George Karloff faction, you had the Mike Malone faction. If you could just get everybody on the same page wanting to do the same thing, and I think, you know, perhaps that'll prove impossible in this environment. I mean, I think, you know, and it all starts at the top, frankly, so far, but maybe, you know, people can change their stripes. You know, there have been a lot of owners who have started off poorly and have kind of learned to take a step back, or at least learned to get everyone on the same page. So when you still have not had a chance yet to have Cousins in a functional environment, now you can also make the argument that he is a big part of why it is dysfunctional. But I think maybe you just give it one more try with a guy who's a great talent. And if you trade him at next year's deadline, at least you can still get something for him, because the receiving team, they might have the ability to renegotiate and extend him if they wanted to. Or at least they will get two playoffs out of him to where you're really willing to give up something pretty significant at that point. And also, you know, you want to trade him while he's younger too, and just has more time ahead of him as well. But I certainly would not wait any later until then, and I would be listening to every possible offer that I could this summer. But they just can't do that moving into the new arena. That would just be cause a fan revolt, I'm sure.
I'm sure. Another piece of signing news is Sean Kilpatrick, who we talked about on the 15 and 60. He had a 10-day contract with the Nets, and according to The Vertical, he is going to sign a 2-year deal with them, so the rest of this year and next year, and it includes some sort of guarantee for next season.
Yeah, we don't know exactly how much that is yet, but that's great for him. I think he has continued to play well. He had another nice game in the box score last night. So when you're shooting 40% on threes, it's pretty tough to not be a valuable player in the NBA, and he's a guy even who can create a little bit off the dribble. He'll never be a starter for sure, but, you know, he could be a microwave type of guy, to be sure.
Yeah. Also, other signings, 10-day contracts, Lorenzo Brown signed with Detroit, Henry Sims with the aforementioned Nets, and Cody Clark signed a second one with Boston.
Sims, I don't think really has any kind of upside at all. He's just not athletic enough. He played plenty in Philly, and they weren't really even interested in bringing him back. It's not a direction I would have tried to find someone with a little more upside. I mean, like, why would you sign Henry Sims over Jarnell Stokes?
Yeah.
For example, if you're Brooklyn.
Especially when you have centers. Like, they have Willie Reed, they have Brooke Lopez. Like, they don't need, that's not as much of a need for them as getting a power forward who can do anything.
Yeah, and Stokes is probably really even more of a center himself.
That's probably
in terms
true.
Of his skill. I mean, maybe his jumper is improving. I don't see him necessarily as a guy who's going to extend it out to the 3-point line. But I mean, if you're any of these teams, New Orleans, who just dumped him, Brooklyn, New York, like we're talking about it, like Stokes actually is someone who might be a little bit more effective in the triangle, for example. Why would you not?
What about the Lakers? What about the Lakers? The Lakers haven't done any of that cycling either. And what do they have that they can't give up?
Yeah, they have enough young guys that they're trying to work in. But yeah, like, and Meta World Peace, I think, has been like, they look at him as a good veteran influence. So I don't know. Yeah, who would you dump if you're the Lakers to sign a Jarnell Stokes?
Do you think Ryan Kelly's going to be on their team next year? I mean, is he?
I might. That's a thought.
Sacre.
Sacre has probably proven that he's never going to. I mean, you need upside guys if you're the Lakers. Like, you don't need a third center. I mean, with given how horrible they've been defensively this year. And how, I mean, Sacre has been a great organizational soldier, and he's a great teammate, but, you know, I think they probably need to move on. That's a good point. They have guys that they can get rid of. That's certainly the case. Lorenzo Brown, Detroit could definitely use more at point guard. Tim Frazier is probably the best guy, at least that I know, in the D League. He just got called up by New Orleans, and noted that Tim Frazier, by the way, is considered an awesome teammate. CJ McCollum, like, we know Dame Lillard loves him. CJ McCollum was, like, retweeting, like, four or five tweets as Tim actually played pretty well for New Orleans the other night in Sacramento. So he's another guy that teammates seem to love. But anyway, this is probably a little bit too much on back end of the roster guys. Lorenzo Brown, not someone I think of as really having any kind of upside, though. I probably would have wanted to go in another direction, but maybe Detroit just sees him as a guy who's just, like, not going to screw up too badly, and they can throw him into that ugly backup point guard mix that they have there.
I don't know if you heard this, but I read somewhere on Twitter that the Pelicans are considering starting Tim Frazier in their next game at the two guard. New Orleans, baby.
Oh, man.
Against Portland. Great. Oh, that'd be super nice. He'd be playing against CJ. Yeah. Oh.
I will say, actually, that for at least half a quarter, that New Orleans game on Monday, Gentry started, I think it was Drew, AD at center, Tony Douglas, Alonzo G, and Dante Cunningham. And that lineup actually did a great job defensively. It all fell apart as soon as Luke Babbitt and Ryan Anderson came in. But they were switching everything. Guys like Douglas, Drew Holiday, they were fighting hard in the posts when Draymond would try to post up. Even AD was switching out onto Steph, and he still does probably the best job of any big man really bothering Steph when he tries to go one-on-one outside. And they actually really, like, bothered the Warriors for about a six-minute period before Alvin Gentry decided he was going to go with Luke Babbitt instead, who then immediately got taken advantage of on, like, three switches in a row. But that's something that maybe could be a little bit of a blueprint for other teams. Obviously, that lineup is never going to get score against a good defense. You know, it wasn't a viable lineup to really win the game, but that's a thought. And actually, Gentry and Darren Erman have been pretty maligned. I thought that they actually at least found a little bit of something that was pretty good for a team that was undermanned, at least for a short time.
And it also showed the value of hustle. Like, those guys were working out there, and that helps a lot. And that's something we didn't see with the Knicks.
We did not see that with the Knicks. All right, let's call it quits for today.
Oh, do you want to say the Grizzlies thing?
No, I'll say that for later. We'll
okay.
Save for the 15 and 60. Basically, they have a really bad point differential and a really good record. That's about it, I guess. I guess that's not really news.
Oh, do we want to talk about the Durant Spurs thing quickly?
Oh, yeah, of course. That's what we missed. Yeah. Well, such a tight show today. yeah, so reported that some GMs have been talking about how. Who had that report? Do you recall?
I do not.
Yeah, this has just been an incredibly tight show today. Anyway, Durant, the Spurs are being talked about as a potential suitor for him. If Tim and Manu come back, it is very unlikely that they would have the cap space for him. But if they don't, there are some ways in which they could do it.
Yeah, I mean, going through all the machinations with the Warriors is a good example of that, that in this market, as long as you don't have bad contracts, basically anything is possible. The difference between the Spurs and some of the teams like the Warriors is that they would have to give up actually important players to do it. So, like, theoretically, they could trade one of their higher salary guys. LaMarcus is one, but probably not him. Tony Parker. But maybe the most likely combination of salary shedding, if Durant basically came to them, would be Danny Green and Boris Diaw. Those guys would probably clear enough if Tim and Manu retire to make it possible. But you'd have a flawed team, of course, with them, but you'd still be quite good.
LaMarcus, Kawhi Leonard, and Tony Parker make about $40 million combined. Parker is actually under contract for another 2 years after this one. Green makes 10. Diaw makes 7.5. But only $3 million of that is guaranteed, although they have to decide on that, whether they're going to guarantee the full 7.5 by June 30th before we move into the new league year. So that could complicate those things a little bit. And then they've got guys like Patty Mills, David West has a player option, Manu, Tim Duncan do as well. So they could fit Durant in. Durant's max would start at probably around $26 million or so. Depending on where the cap falls, but you know, with our current projection on 92. So they could fit him in. They'd probably be pretty thin. I think the biggest problem would be that I don't think that they can politically move on from Tony Parker, despite the fact that he is probably like the worst salary that they will have on the books at that time. So it could happen. Durant and Kawhi playing together would be unbelievable. This one doesn't seem to have as much legs as the LaMarcus one does to me. If I had to guess, this is not going to be something that's seriously going to be considered by Durant, but hey, you never know.
It proves how, other than Cleveland, every team is open. And so whatever Durant wants to do, wherever he wants to go, if he says yes, you can make it work.
All right, that will do it for today. Please listen to the all-time NBA rank podcast that I did with Royce Webb and Kevin Pelton. That's a good one. That'll hold up for a while. So put that one in your queue and listen to it whenever you want. We'll be back talking about one of my favorite subjects, which is the top 10 players in the NBA over the weekend as well. And, of course, support the program using that cap space code on SeatGeek, the Postmates app where you can get anything delivered that you want from any store, essentially. Use the cap space code on there as well. They're a new sponsor. And follow us on Twitter, Nate Duncan NBA and Danny LaRue. We will talk to you all next time.